says, I'm going to go to work somewhere. And around about the age of 20, I went to work for the Southern Railway at the Spencer Shops as a laborer at the big sum of 9 cents an hour. And this is one move that I've made that I've never regretted. The first job I got was in the roundhouse, helping a man that put on pipe clamps and other little things where they tore down the jackets and stuff to their repair. And it was our job to put the clamps back on to hold the pipes rigid. And of course I did other jobs. And from there, I went to the storage department that was organized about the time that the shops was organized. The shops, to my recollection, we had an old railroad shop down on North Lee Street and adjoining the Western Railroad in that the triangle in there, and they moved that shop with the shop from Burlington to Spencer and consolidated them. And it was with this small shop that I went to work in June of 1907, and I stayed with this company for 52 and a half years and didn't miss a paycheck. Mm. Now, when I went to the storage department, they had a long, lanky storekeeper by the name of Charlie Norman. They brought from Atlanta, and also they had a chief clerk that they'd brought from the old R&D Railroad in Manchester, which is South Richmond. And they were the two bosses that I went to work for. And for some reason or another, this division storekeeper picked me out to help him to take monthly checks of what stock we had on hand to enable him to replace what had been used. And
you were working as a laborer,
laborer,
and he just kind of picked you out?
I went from the roundhouse to the storehouse and became a storehouse man. In other words, I stored brass and things such as lamp globes and pipes and pipe fittings and rivets and wood screws and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff in their proper bins where there was a little tag on it mm-hmm. showing what size and what it was, and bolts. It wasn't a very large storehouse. That is a wooden storehouse, which today is halfway between the brick Master Mechanics building and the brass flue shop that later became the electric shop. And that was the old building. Now that building, if you will notice the rafters up in the top, there was a big fire in it one time. But I do remember this. In 1908, it's been written up several times in the newspapers of a big explosion, because we had a platform across the tracks from the water tank on the east side, where the master mechanic's office was in the front part of this wooden storehouse, and the storage department and office was in the about three quarters of the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about an 8-foot platform extending from the building to the tracks. And up at the, and we also had some castings on the platform at the north end. Now at the north end of this platform, they had about an 8x10 steel building where we stored fusees and torpedoes, which were inflammable. And one day in 1908, I believe that's the year, just after the shop, there was a shop train that would bring the employees from Salisbury three times a day and let them get it on and off at the storehouse platform. And it was lucky, the day that the explosion was, the shop train had pulled out for Salisbury.
Mm-hmm.
And that saved a lot of lives.
Was anybody killed?
I can't tell you. I don't think there was. But it damaged the buildings greatly. And
what were they doing with torpedoes there?
Torpedoes is for the transportation people that puts on the rail, for the engineer and fireman. And the fusee is a danger signal for the train crew. But there's a train ahead. That's before you had all this electronic materials, such as semaphores and so forth. And they're highly inflammable. But later we did away with, we also carried dynamite, because we used dynamite before we got the experience of how to do it otherwise. They used to blow the staples out of the boilers in the locomotives when they had the locomotives in the shop for repairs. See, these staples would leak, and they would have to take it out and ream a new hole and make a stable to fit the new where the threads were. And of course, I think there was some dynamite in this building also. That's when they made a change by blowing out the staples. And
how big is a staple?
A staple run anywhere from 15/16 to about 1 1/4 inches in diameter in 16ths and 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that goes in the crown sheet to hold the two sheets together. That's what I'd call the combustion chamber of a locomotive. And as I told you, I went to work in 1907, and in 1912 and 13, I climbed a little bit, and there was a vacancy on what we had a supply train. This was a train composed of about 4 or 5 cars. It was put on the locals. Each day we had a schedule where we would travel about 50 to 60 miles a day in those days. That was about a day's work. Delivering the car seals, brooms, toilet paper, and different oils and lamps, burners, chimneys, and most everything that a nation, or like a housewife would put in her kitchen, toilet articles and soaps and stuff like that, and distribute, and also distribute nails and other stuff to the maintenance away, B&B people. And
what's B&P stand for?
That building in the bridge and building and department. And then we did head in and refill and go out on another division. We had 4 or 5 divisions that the supply cars run on out of Spencer.
Was there much fooling around on the job, or?
Oh, they'd take a drink now and then during the working hour.
Really?
Oh, yes, I'd knock a menu day on the job. And that was one of the incidents that happened in that department. Now, about after 1913, I came off supply cars, and they made me stock clerk, a storehouse man. And then it wasn't long before I was made a general clerk, which is, at that time, was equivalent to general foreman in our department. And then I did increase my pay to $55 a month, and I was in paradise. Mm-hmm. That was a big salary back in 1918. Then along came the First World War, when we were under government control and under Mr. McAdoo, and he raised our salaries. I jumped from $55 to $125 a month. And it wasn't long before I was made chief stock clerk, and in 1921-22, I was took up to Washington to help make the settlements with the inventories on the system. It was an immense thing that they scattered over 8,000 miles of railroad at about 25, 30, 40, 50 different locations. And I worked on that, and we were the only railroad that paid the government off in black the First World War. And by the manipulation, the company didn't suffer a bit. I think that's one of the reasons why they kept me on the railroad. And but then every time I'd squawk about a raise, a transfer up the line, they told me they wanted to keep me where I was, and they increased my salary.
Hmm.
During the 1930s, when most people in this country was working for a dollar a day and selling apples, and prosperity was just around the corner with Herbert Hoover, I was making $500 a month in my expense account.
That was a great salary.
It was. I was up in the package. And later on, a lot of things happened. When I came into a fellowship, I was making $750 a month in 1948. But now I'm getting ahead of my story. Going back to the railroad, I've seen a lot of things happen on the railroad. And I remember once, now I'm rambling, there's a lot of years in between some of these. I do know of seeing a man where he fell into the lye pit that was caustic soda, boiling steam water and caustic soda, where they put all the mechanism of the locomotives, that is the rigging like underneath, that they cut, that locomotive up there on the wall. And to get the grease off, and he stumbled and fell in there, and it took all the meat off of all of his bones.
Mm.
And I think that's the worst accident. I remember an old fellow Brown was in the blacksmith shop up overhead working on pulleys and shafting, and somehow or another the end of the shafting caught his overhauls, and it ripped all his clothes off except the socks and his shoes and slung him 20 feet. But I think one of the greatest miracles that ever happened, I had a friend that was in the electrical department that was working in the erecting shop, and he was overhead with the cranes, and for some reason he came in contact with 4,400 volts of electricity, and it went through his body, slung him to the ground, and the man survived. I think that's one of the greatest miracles that's happened. I've seen a lot of animosity in the shops. I remember one of my earliest storekeepers, W.A. Muller, I called him Bill. He was a brainy duck. And they said he used to be the traveling storekeeper. And I first came in contact with him because I went up to Washington. When I first went to Washington, my first visit in Washington was during when Mr. Wilson was inaugurated, and there's about 2 or 3 feet of snow on the ground. And the general storekeeper at that time, Johnny Gerber, who was to be my partner for many, many years after that, told this man, W.A. Muller, to take me and Charlie out for dinner because we didn't have an expense account.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, and that's when I came into contact with him. And then from 1920 to 1937, I worked a week to 10 days every month in the general office in Washington. First, I used to work down in the Southern Railroad building at 1300 Pennsylvania Avenue, where we sold it to the government, the Coast Guard. And we had a fire in that old building, fire before we sold it. And I worked some over in the Muncie building across Pennsylvania Avenue, almost a couple doors above the National Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Then later on, we built a new office building up at McPherson Square. And I used to live at the Hamilton and the Ambassador Hotels. They're opposite one another, only 2 blocks away from the general office. And I knew Washington like a top. And then later on in 1937, when we set up another different setup, I came back to Spencer and I stayed at Spencer headquarters because my office was on the top floor of the Mass Mechanics Building on the east corner. And I had all my stock clerks in there. And the storehouse men, of course, worked down in the storeroom. Going back to storehouse men, I remember one time during Charlie Norman's time, we were going to be taking inventory of all the material we had on hand to send to the general office. And I told every one of them, I said, all you SBs got to work tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty rough with them. I had about 150 men at that time. And I was sitting at my desk, which is part of the storehouse now, where it used to was cut off from the big wall in the master mechanic's office. And there was another clerk sitting right across back of some file boxes back of me. And a woman, two women came in. One stood on one side of my back and one on the other. And just like on each side of your chair. And one of them asked me, says, are you Dick Boston? I said, yep. Says, I'm so-and-so. Says, yeah, you give out an order that every SB had to work Sunday. Yeah, I mean that. Says, well, let me tell you something. My husband is not going to work, and you're not going to find him. About that time, I felt something against my ribs. I knew what that was. Any damn fool would have known what it was. I guess him. I said, he can be all. With pleasure. Yes, ma'am. And I said, I don't forget. I went upstairs after the incident. I told Charlie, I was a C.J. Norman,
mm-hmm.
the storekeeper. But Charlie, I had a damn run-in with a woman downstairs. And he laughed. He said, what did she do? And she stuck a gun in my ribs. She did? Yeah. I said, what'd you tell her? I said, hell, her husband could be off. He said, well, that's all right. We can take care of him later some other way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the incidents that I was sort of scared. Now, I also told you about W.A. Miller before we started this tape recorder, that there was a lot of animosity because I told you about Charlie Norman carrying the nuts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And him and Bill Miller was sent to Spencer's, the storekeeper. He had no use for the blacksmith shop foreman. And I was the go-between. I was the messenger delivery boy.
Between who now?
Between the division storekeeper and chief blacksmith shop foreman. He had around about 40 or 50 furnaces and blacksmiths. It was a big one. That building's been demolished now. It's at the lower end of the machine shop on the south corner coming this way towards the old transit yards outside the rear shop fence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd take the messages to the blacksmith shop foreman and back to Bill Miller, and that's the way we did business. Now also, when I was stock clerk, the foremen used to make out their monthly list. It was the same year in and year out, month in and month out. And no business survives on that kind, and we come out losing their records.
Mm-hmm.
They'd give us devils. We lost them purposely. So we couldn't go over with an order exorbitant stocks of material that later would have to be scrapped. And that was money thrown away. I think that's one of the reasons why the mechanic people hated us to a certain extent. And we had another instance when Jim Goodloe was storekeeper around the 1930s, latter times at 20s and early 30s. This same blacksmith shop foreman, he was a cankerous old duck, and used to have a goatee, and he's always doing that to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did one instant, I've been not that put on that tape too. And now when John had, there was a controversy about some a certain size bar iron or steel.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big iron rack, but I reckon about the structural steel, but I reckon Oh, I reckon it'd be 200,000-300,000 pounds of all sizes.
Mm.
Because the length varied as they run from the mills. And he contended there wasn't none out there. So I sent one of my stock clerks over to show him where it was, to see if it was over there. And it was over there. And this boy went into Mr. Connolly and told him, said, Mr. Connolly, that there, I think it's 1 1/4 before, steel was making the tie bars for the trucks. Said, that steel's laying right out, son. Said, you're a liar. I bet you $20 it ain't out there. And he cussed the boy out. And he come back over to my office. I mean, the tears was running down his face. He was a good-natured old country boy. And he just couldn't take that.
Mm-hmm.
He was thin-skinned in a way. And he told me the story. I said, well, there ain't nobody going to talk to you that way. I went into Jim Goodloe. And at that time, Joe Campbell was master mechanic. My boss went down to Joe. And I was standing at the window. I thought maybe something was going to happen. I wanted to see who was going over to the master mechanic's office to the blacksmith shop, which was about, walking would be about 400 or 500 feet.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 minutes, there wasn't nobody walked. About 2 minutes, I saw the assistant shop foreman running, Carl Lent. About a minute or two, my phone rang. Said, you and Ollie come down here. That master mechanic told Tom Connolly. Said, Mr. Connolly, you got two choices. You either remain on the job or be fired. You're going to get down on your knees and beg this man's pardon for treating him like a damn dog. And he made that arrogant, old, wicked cuss get down on his knees and beg him for that boy's pardon. Boy, we got along fine with him after that. That's what he needed. But now that wasn't the animosity among all the people. Of course, in the beginning I told you there's a little hatred and animosity because we took the storage department away from the mechanical people, and later on, about 65 years, the time the storage department was formed, it went back to them under another division name sometime in the early 60s after I retired.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a good comradeship among the men, except they had a lot of grievances, though, because sometimes the pipe fitters and tenors, the thickness of the of steel plates, they had a lot of bearing. What department worked it? You see, we had 1/16th, 1/32nd, stove pipe iron, galvanized steel, you know, thin, which would belong to the pipe fitters.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get up to a 3/16th and 1/4-inch plate steel, that belonged to the boilermakers. And then it come to the point, there's a lot of arguments over whose job it was to dismantle this, or dismantle or restore after it was repaired, put back on the locomotives of the cars. And that was about the greatest animosity. There was a pretty good relationship among the different people in the shops as far as I could ascertain. Because if anybody got sick, any death or anything, and they passed the hat,
mm-hmm.
then there was no griping about it. They was very generous to a fault almost.
Yeah.
And I've seen the attitude change a whole lot because there was enough of jobs. I think at the height, after between World War I and up to World War II, we had around about 2,300 people on our payrolls. That included the engineers, firemen, which is the transportation department, brakemen, and then we had the shop people too. Because all that was paid for by checks. Of course, during the First and Second World War, when labor was scarce, we paid those blacks, those laborers and stuff, all weekly to hold them. And then we'd furnish a payroll to the agent, Spencer, Earl Clapp, and they would figure out how many fives, tens, ones, 15, four dimes, pennies, so they could give the man the exact amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And in about 4 years of paying off weekly, in the grand totals, we were not but $2 or $3 in 4 or 5 years. That's pretty good manipulation.
Mm.
And I was one time that didn't pay by checks. I remember a lot of funny incidents that shouldn't go to the public that happened on the railroads, and some of them was colorful. You cut that off. I remember one thing that happened during the first big strike in the early 20s, which was a nationwide strike. It lasted a good bit. It brought a lot of people down. Some of them was tailors, and some of them haberdashery people. Didn't know a thing in the world about locomotives or anything about them. And give them jobs with no questions asked. It was manpower. And to hold them, we used to have a contact with the bootleggers. It was during the 18th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And we made contact with the bootleggers. It wasn't hard for me to do that. And the bootlegger during the night would deliver around about 25 to 30 gallons in 5 and 10 gallon cans and put them in the master mechanic's garage. Next day I'd take a half ton truck, go down there and get that and bring it into the shops, and we allocated about a pint to a quart to various people, and that's the way we held them. But going back to the railroads, Spencer, when I first went there, we had no mechanized equipment whatsoever. The only thing they had was these old warehouse trucks that had an iron axle that we put coal, that's one grade of oil, a thick oil, on the axle to turn. No rollers or no ball bearings or nothing. And I've seen the equipment change drastically. I've also seen the type of equipment change drastically. You take on the, say, boxcars and flat cars. I know that the seals underneath, 4, 5, 6 seals, used to be wooden ones, 6x8s mostly. And they were put together with a steel plate on each end with big draft bolts, 7/8 inches that run anywhere from 20 to 30 inches in length, about every 2 inches, every inch. And then later on we got the Bradford draft gear that was an all-steel end, and today you have these cushion-type big knuckle. You take the couplers. When I first went on the railroad, it was a little 5x5 shank up and down, and with a 9-inch knuckle, and the knuckle pin was a 1 5/8 by 13 inches that goes in the knuckle head, that holds the knuckle head into the knuckle. I've seen that grow up to 6x8, and it's a big, wide, a butt end that goes in the draft gear at least 8.5 to 12.5 inches and 6 inches thick. And then also we built in our own shops approximately 4,000 Putwood cars and Pennelli 4 or 5. I had to order, buy or procure from different steel warehouses 56 tons of structural steel a year till we built 4,000 steel cars. And that was a pretty good sized job in itself. Of course, that included rivets and I-beams, and the plates was mostly 1/2 inch to 5/8 inch thick, and they were cut to exact size so that they wouldn't have no waste. And when they would use these plates, some department would use any of these plates for the pulpwood cars, we had to replace that out of steel warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept you sort of busy being a watchdog watching it. Because a lot of them didn't want to tell you when they used it for another purpose.
They weren't using it for what they were supposed to sometimes?
Yeah, that's right.
What would they have used it for?
Other purposes. Might have used it on a locomotive.
Mm-hmm. What's a pumpwood car?
Pumpwood car, you've seen these logs being hauled.
Yeah.
Round logs, about 4 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
The two sides in, that's a pumpwood car. It's lumber, it's lumber, trees cut down to make pulpwood out of. And we call it pulpwood cars.
I got you.
Of course, now we have experimented on building some different types of locomotives. I remember we took a 27-30 Makata, that's a 27-inch diameter, and a 30-inch stroke piston locomotive, a six-wheeler, and I put the chassis of a smaller one under the tender part to give it more power, but they made it an articulated engine, we called it. But it didn't succeed. We experimented a whole lot with air resistance and stuff. I remember when I first commenced buying fuel oil for our diesel, I was given 8 and 9 cents a gallon for it. And look what it is today. I think the last time I bought any used here in my house was 94.5 cents a gallon. And I used to buy it for 8 and 9 cents a gallon. That shows you how commodities has gone up.
Sure
and,
has.
I've seen a lot of improvements on the railroad, as you have read, perhaps, and so have others, that we are one of the 5 best governed corporations in the United States. I think the American Telephone and Telegraph Company comes first, R.J. Reynolds Industry, Southern Railroad, and 2 big chain outfits.
Mm-hmm.
And the Southern Railroad, for a long time, did not pay anything on its common stock. But later on, they commenced to get giving us dividends. We got a little bit of it up here in the bank.
Hmm.
It sort of helps.
Did most of the workers for the railroad end up buying stock?
They let them buy now. But they didn't up the time I retired.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I wasn't known to be. My family bought it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. But they sold us bonds during the war. I got bonds, I'm not bragging, I got bonds up in my safety deposit box dated back to 1941 that runs out the end of this year.
Mm.
Every month. We got $100 bond and I got them all.
Mm.
There's some of them worth almost 3 times what it originally cost. My sister had 1 safety deposit box full of bonds when she died last year. They're still laying up there.
Did a lot of people buy bonds regularly?
Yeah, they forced us.
They forced you to?
That is, the foremans. And they couldn't force the craftsmen.
Mm-hmm.
But they highly recommended it. See, they made the $100 bond cost $75.
Right.
And right today it's worth about $44.